Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, we'd like to welcome you to another program of Africa on the Move. That's right, this is Africa on the Move, where y'all listen to Brother African. Today we decided to go to the Far East and talk about some of its history. Its history in relationship to the people's struggles on a daily basis. And with us to discuss that, we're going to discuss this issue of a 40-year war in Laos, which many people call it the secret war. And to discuss this particular topic with us, we are fortunate to have a young man who has just came back from Laos, and he's going to give us an update on the current reality of Laos, and we're going to really talk about what took place 40 years ago and how these particular past events is impacting people of color around the world. Right now, we'd like to welcome our guest, Louis Wolf. He's an organized participant of Schools of America, as well as a co-founder of Covert Action Magazine. Louis, welcome to Africa on the Move. Hello, can you hear us, Brother Louis? Brother Louis Wolf, welcome to Africa on the Move. There seem to be we have some technical difficulties on that note. Until we can get back with Brother Louis Wolf, what we're going to do is we have some of our listening audience online who would like to share some perspectives on some of the current events and things that are going on. Until we can get back with our scheduled guests, we will first open up the program with Brother Haki. We'd like to welcome you to welcome to Africa on the Move, Brother Haki. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
But like you were scheduled, really, to talk a little bit about what's the 40-year secret war, what is going on in around the world as it relates to the history of U.S. and their foreign policy, more particular. And when you talk about that institution, we're really talking about the CIA. But we're going to save that for our guests. And I think our guests, let me see if we got our guests back on again. Let me see. Hold up for 1 second, please. Hello, do we have Brother Louis Wolf on the line? Brother Louis Wolf? 4298? Okay, we guess not. We're going to put this call on hold. But what we're going to do right now, Brother Haki, I'd like for you just to talk a little bit, you know, since we've been dealing with this question of democracy and how these ideas are being used in the names of killing millions of people. From your own historical understanding of this concept of developing this concept of democracy as a practice in the West, i.e. led by the U.S. government, what are some of the primary contradictions that you see in this whole concept of democracy and how it has been applied historically?
Well, I think the term itself is a bit of a misnomer. I think there are people in society who believe that, in fact, democracy is an egalitarian concept where the greatest good for the greatest number of people prevailed. One thing we have to understand, when you look at the historical roots in terms of democracy, we have to understand that the philosopher Democritus, when he talked about democracy, he was talking about, in fact, that the wealthy make the rules. And if that being true, then we understand that we live in the context of society in which, in fact, the 1%, in fact, rule. In fact, everything they do is in benefit for the 1%. And so the needs and aspirations of the 99% of the people is a non-issue. And conversely, so when we look around the world and we talk about the needs of the people throughout the world, then we have to be very, very clear. We don't have a governance structure that's particularly concerned about, you know, economic scales or particularly concerned about fairness, concerned about the ecological damage to the society. The primary focus of this government system is the pursuit of profit and control. And so we have to understand this is the quintessential aspect when we talk about this whole thing in terms of democracy. And one of the things that you see, you can't talk seriously about the...
3, 2, 2. Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, we're still on.
Yeah, you can't seriously talk about the democratic. You can't seriously.
Okay, Brother Haki, in terms of these democracies, how do you see the different kind of institutions? Let's talk about political education institutions. How do they reinforce these contradictions, and what would it take to change the mass of the people when they began to talk about democracy and make it become the kind of concept based upon the masses of the people understanding, which is normally really the bottom line is having the participation by the people, for the people, of the people. How can we deal with these institutions that play a major role of creating false illusions of these concepts and causing harm to millions of people around the world? For example, if you talk to a U.S. soldier, you know, he's really under the disguise that when he go abroad, he is carrying out a policy that is based upon the good of the people on this concept of democracy. And a lot of times he has no idea what he's doing. He's doing the contrary, the opposite. And he's been definitely influenced and being educated by the education system here, the political system here. So how can we first look at the role of institutions in this country? And two, how do we transform this reactionary idea of democracy as been practiced by the West to make it become a real concept where it does truly benefit the will and the interests of the people?
I think first and foremost is the question of education is very, very important. I think first and foremost we have to distinguish between democracy as a concept and democracy as a principle. Currently, as we understand democracy as a concept, so the closest to the concept because those in control determine the concept. So quite easily they can deceive the masses of people in terms of believing something that in fact is not true. It's sort of like the matrix analogy where people see Can you hear me? Hello?
Okay, well, do it.
Okay. Now, in terms of along this line, the line of thought, Brother Aki, let me raise a question, and you tell me, based upon you being able to travel around the world and being able to see the behaviors of the people, how do you look at issues of, let's say, a country like Cuba, where they say they don't have a democracy, but at the same time, the people have a greater input in their society than what many people have over here.
That speaks to the role of institutions in society. As I alluded to before, we have a institutional infrastructure which essentially conceptualizes this whole question in terms of democracy. And because it's conceptualized and those...
Yes, we have you, Brother Buswell. Thank you. Just
I'm here.
Go ahead, Hacky. Good, good. Okay. We now have a guest. We've been waiting for you. We hold 1 second and other presenter will finish his point. Go ahead, Brother Hacky.
Well, I simply want to say that the problem is that it's one to conceptualize this whole concept, this notion of a democracy. And so I think that in the context of America, then we understand that when we talk about democracy or representative democracy, in fact, what we're talking about is the right of the 1% or the capitalist class, in fact, to rule. And so therefore, as long as those institutions in society mirror, you know, those sentiments, then we can reasonably expect that the masses of the people, in fact, will be deceived, be duped and believing that, in fact, this is the greatest system in the world. And you contrast that with a system like Cuba, which is more democratic in the sense that people actually participate in the governance. Then clearly, you know, even though U.S. would say they don't have institutions that are democratic, but in terms of how the institutions in Cuba work, they are very democratic in terms of, you know, power being exercised from the bottom up. And so, therefore, the people on the bottom have a say-so in terms of, you know, the kind of policies that shape the government. And so that is very, very key in terms of understanding this concept of democracy. And if we're going to truly bring about real democracy as a principle in society, then it calls for a great education. And that calls for something that the people will have to do unilaterally. We can't realistically call upon the government or the institutions in terms of to engage in struggles around what democracy really means and what it means to the lives of human beings. And so, therefore, the key here is simply, essentially, is education. So I think that is the key in terms of bringing the change to this thing.
Good. We'd like to alert our audience. We now have our scheduled guests for the show today. We have worked out the technical difficulties. As we stated to you earlier, we would like to discuss the 40-year secret war in Laos, its impact and its implication. And we are very fortunate to have with us Brother Louis Wolf, who is an organizer for the School of Americas, and he also is the co-founder for Covert Action. We now have him on the line, and we'd like to welcome Brother Wolf to Africa on the Move. Welcome, Brother Wolf, to Africa on the Move.
Thank you, Brother Lee, so much, and forgive me, I called in but was unable to get through until now. Let me just say, by way of introduction, that I spent 2.5 years in Laos as a conscientious objector during the secret war there. They offered me a chance to go, because I was at the time I was a pacifist. I did not want to kill people. That's as simple as it was. I wasn't trying to escape the draft. I just refused to kill people, period. Especially people that I didn't even know who they were or what they were about. Of course, I learned very quickly upon landing there in October 1964. It was called a secret war, but the Lao always said to us, it's no secret from us. We're the targets. We are the people being bombed. Laos, for your listeners to know, in the history of warfare, I'm saying in the history of warfare, no country has been bombed more than Laos, or as much as Laos, if you measure in terms of the tons of ordnance that was dropped on Laos. And still today, the bombs are going off today. The war ended officially, the secret war ended in 1975, but still the bombs are exploding. They're called bombies. They're also called UXOs, or UXOs, or unexploded ordnance. Even while we were there, and I just came back a few weeks ago, a bomb exploded in Savannakhet, which is in southern Laos, killing 5 people, 3 of whom were children. So, you know, the war is still going on there. And we visited 2 institutions which work with this cause of finding and demilitarizing all of this ordnance that's still in the ground in Laos. We met amputees. Being an amputee myself, I could certainly identify very quickly and very deeply with them. Most of them were children when this happened. Some were adults when it happened. I have to tell you that it's extraordinarily powerful to hold somebody in your arms who lost a leg or an arm because of a bomb that was dropped on Laos. The pilots used to say when I was there, we dumped the bombs coming back from Vietnam because we can't land on the aircraft carriers in Thailand or in Okinawa if we're carrying any ordnance in the back. So they used the word dumping or dumped. And if you fly over Laos today, it looks like literally like a moonscape with all of the bomb craters. One of the institutions we visited, they had a mobile hanging from the ceiling, which had hanging on the ends of the strings hundreds of demilitarized bombies, the size of tennis balls or even grapefruits. And can you just imagine the feeling of walking under this mobile as it floats in the air? And that's what the Lao were facing, and in some ways still do. So,
can you tell our audience, from your understanding, what is the basis of the secret war? What motivates them to do this, to go to Laos and engage in this kind of secret war? What is it that they will get out of it? What's the aid?
What would they get out of it?
The U.S.
Well, many of America's wars are about the three-letter word, oil, or other resources, other natural resources, minerals, and so forth. Laos has none of these. Laos's major export is teak wood, the beautiful wood that they have there in abundance. We drove and walked through a teak forest that are as deep and thick as you can imagine any forest. But What Laos represented was in the time of anti-communism, which I would suggest continues today in other names, but in those days it was about fighting communism, and the communism coming from North Vietnam and South Vietnam, as well as, of course, the major enemy at the time was the Soviet Union. Gradually it became China as well. And so Laos, which is bordered on its if you look on the map, on its eastern border, from top to bottom, bordered by Vietnam. And there was the famous Ho Chi Minh Trail there, which was used by the Vietnamese during their struggle against the war as a route for moving weapons and food, rice and water up and down that trail. And so that was heavily bombed. But right next door is Laos. And literally, you can walk across that border today and you'll see it. And so it represented a natural enemy for the United States because Laos was also involved in a major armed struggle against its undemocratic and very corrupt government at the time, the so-called Royal Lao government, which was heavily funded by the U.S. That's what was the basis. But there was another layer to it, and that was the movement of opium. Opium was grown in major numbers in acreage in various parts of Laos, and so. But it wasn't the Lao that were making anything off it. It was the generals in the Royal Lao government, and also a lot of the pilots that I was speaking to were moving that opium in their aircraft.
Exactly. When you talk about moving large sums of drugs, you're also talking about the role of the Central Intelligence Agency. Can you talk about the role of the CIA and its role in Laos?
Well, you know, we used to see them by the dozens in their khaki shirts and their khaki pants, or plaid shirts and khaki pants, roaming various parts of Laos. They stood out like you can't imagine. They were really deeply involved in so much of the struggle there. Actually, William Colby, the former director of the CIA, called Laos, it's one of our success stories. Well, the success story to William Colby was that we killed upwards of 2 million people there. By extension, of course, meaning the United States, were very much dedicated to supporting a status quo which could not include the people of Laos. It was very much of a top-down movement or top-down government, which the U.S. was supporting. They even had a so-called KIP support program. The money, the currency in Laos is KIP, the KIP, like our dollar. And they actually had constructed a so-called KIP support program, which was supposed to keep the currency at a high level and the economy thereby. But the economy was in the toilet at that time. The best economic factor was the opium trade, and so. But that only served the interests of the people that the U.S. was supporting. I was supposed to work for a short time with a man his name was Edgar Buell, Pop Buell. He gave himself the name Pop because he was running the secret war in northern Laos, and I was supposed to teach the nurses that were helping in the clinic that was near where his base was to treat the wounded coming back from the secret war that Pop Buell was running. Well, he gave himself the name Pop. Why? Because all of a sudden the children were orphans in this war that he was running. And so I called him to his face, a war criminal, he's dead now, but he can't speak for himself. But the fact is that he represented the CIA infrastructure there, along with several thousand others.
Yeah, you know, Brother Lou, I was doing some research on the Secret War, and you alluded to how you saw the impact of all these bombs that have been dropped in Laos. And the process of looking at all the bombs that has been dropped in Laos, I'd like to just for you talk to us a little bit more about the human toll that it has taken on the people. Because I don't think there has been no other country that has been bombed as much as Laos. For example, based on my research, they stated that over a nine-year span, if you average about eight minutes a day, 24 hours in a day, bombs have been dropped in Laos for consecutively over 9 years. That's a lot of bombing and a lot of uranium going into the ground. So what are the harmful effects have the people encounter as a result of that?
Well, if listeners can just think what living under that kind of level of bombing of you never could sleep, you never could have a moment of relaxation or fear was always facing them from day to night and day again. And so the human cost, I would say, was not only, if it wasn't already bad enough, to some 2 million people dying. And mind you, their population before the war started was about 6 million. That's the size of the country. So to lose more than a third of their people just in the space of that war, that you translate that to this country. If we lost, let's say, 70 million people, how would we feel about it, right? And that's what they live with today as the war, as they look back on that part of their history. A further piece is the chemical warfare that was used in Laos. Most of your listeners have heard of Agent Orange, which was used in Vietnam. Well, in Laos, they used different colors. Agent Blue, which is even more toxic and more harmful to people than even than Agent Orange was. And many of our veterans coming back from Vietnam are now suffering and still dying today from the effects of Agent Orange. Their wives are bearing children with the most ghastly deformities you can imagine still today. So the Vietnamese, their mothers are bearing children still today that are showing the effects of that. Well, the same in Laos, although I won't suggest as quite as much on the same level, but the Pentagon still refuses to release the mapping that they did of the use of Agent Blue and other colors of chemical agents against Laos. So we're trying to get that data released, and so the Lao can find ways medically to rebuild their nation.
You know, Lou, I'll go first. Before you ask this question, I'd like to alert our listening audience that we'll be taking phone calls in the next 2 to 3 minutes. You can dial 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. Dial in. Make sure you hit one. Now, Lou, in terms of this question, before we take out the phone calls, I want you to talk about a little bit, what is the status of the present government, and what was the status of the government prior before, I believe, the coup? Was it that government a Democratic-elected government?
Lee, I didn't understand the question. It was garbled. Real quick, to say again, please.
Can you just get the people, what is the status? What is the status of the present government? What is the makeup of the present government?
Oh, the status of the present government. Well, the Lao government, unfortunately, it's a socialist government. Unfortunately, the unfortunate part is that there is some corruption, serious level of corruption has come in. It is one of the four or five, I should say, countries in the world today that is known as a socialist country and says so. They're proud of it. But the corruption, unfortunately, has come in at different levels. The U.S. Really has not given very much aid at all to heal the wounds of the war we did there. If there's any aid, it's very superficial and very minimal in numbers. So They are building, I saw while I was there, they're building a new, a much bigger embassy than even they had before. So that's not a good sign to me. If they're building a big embassy, that means they're thinking of other efforts to affect changing laws. Last thing I would say is that Hillary Clinton first voiced the so-called, turn to Asia, and the pivot to Asia. And I think it's largely about China. It's not about Laos, not about Vietnam, it's about China. So your listeners should know that for what it is.
Can you just briefly tell us, and then we'll go to our phone lines, and we'd like to alert this audience that if you do not hear the entirety of this program, you can always go to our archive at www.blogtalkradio.com/Africa-on-the-move, okay? So, Lou, in terms of this present government, was this government a democratic elected government? Then we'll go to our phone calls. How did this government come to power, was it? Go ahead, Lou.
Hello? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The government, they have the Communist Party of Laos, but they have had an election there. It's in some ways similar to what you described in Cuba, though quite different. It's an Asian, very Asian. They do have elections, but it's a party. The party is the head of the government. I will say that, yes.
Okay, let's go to that caller. Caller, we can call out your last four number. Please state your question or comment, please. We're going to our first caller, caller number 7628. Do you have a question or comment? Caller number 7628. Okay. Let's try caller 4298. Your question or comments, caller. Caller 4298. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, this is Robert Moses. I'm concerned that you're saying, what year was the election? You know approximately what year they had the last elections in Laos?
The last election was 2004. I believe,
okay,
yes. Is that your question?
Yeah, that's good. That's what I need to know.
Okay.
Okay, let's go to our next caller. Okay, caller 3330. Caller 3330. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment. And my comment is, doing research on this particular region in the world, I don't find it surprising that such actions took place when you look at the desire of, in particular, I know one of the traditional European powers, the French, have always wanted to have some level of control in the world in terms of its location regarding for transportation purposes, access to resources, and also in terms of influence, looking at the history with the culture there, as a way for them to make a lot of money and extend the desire to always have a colonial empire of some kind.
Okay, Carlos, well, come in and go ahead, Lou.
You know, when you talk about empire, the U.S. is all about empire these days, and certainly the Lao have no empire notions or policies that even could come close to anything of that nature. The Laos is a very small and a very, very small country and very humble. But at the same time, they're a very proud country. It's a country that's very highly devoted to its history, its religion, and so there's no sense of empire in Laos. It's about survival. It's about trying to build a country where the people can recover from an extraordinarily harmful war.
And Brother Haki, do you have any comments you'd like to make on this subject tonight?
No, I'd just like to ask the question around U.S. involvement. If, in fact, there is any U.N. involvement, and if it does exist, to what extent do you think the U.N. can impact on U.S. foreign policy in terms of minimizing its destructiveness.
The impact of what on? I couldn't understand the question. I'm sorry.
Call it again. Hey, repeat the question.
Is there any UN involvement in terms of addressing historical wrongs committed by the U.S. government in Laos?
You mean the UN, United Nations?
United Nations, yes.
Yes. The UN has been interested, as in fact, among other things, has talked about the fact, and you can look it up in the UN development, the volume that the UN puts out every year, the UN development program. And they talk about the U.S. being, Laos being the most heavily bombed country in the history of warfare. The U.N. does have an office there, a small office, but I'm not really well informed on what they're doing in Laos.
Okay. Hey, Lou, in terms of looking at this 40-year war, from being a historian, looking back, and then giving a present assessment, what are some of the things people need to learn from this behavior as it relates to the behavior of the U.S. government and their foreign policy?
Well, you know, Americans are always told that we are the greatest nation on the face of the earth. I've heard those words again and again from every president in my lifetime. I'm in my well into my 70s. They say that to suggest to the people of this country that we have what is known as an exceptionalism, the right to rule and the right to intervene anywhere we choose and any time we choose. And I fear that that's sort of a legacy of the Vietnam and Laos War, and I should add certainly Cambodia, where several million people were slaughtered as well by the CIA-supported Khmer Rouge. So those three countries suffered extraordinarily from this war. And the fact is that that exceptionalism has seeped into our national, both domestic and foreign policy, so that every politician thinks that we are exceptional. We, the United States, are exceptional in this world. And so, therefore, that translates at home in our policies towards the poor and the people undersalaried and underpaid, people with without homes, the homeless, and so forth. Well, we're exceptional, so don't worry about it. Or just we will solve those issues as time goes on because we are exceptional. I'm sorry to keep repeating that, but that is what it is.
Mm-hmm. In terms of speaking with the people, what is your assessment in terms of how do you view the American people today and its government? How is the American view today based upon your observation being there?
Well, I will tell you that the Lao people on the street aren't what could be called anti-American. They hate what and they despise what was done to them. But, you know, we were greeted as friends. People understood once we could say, when I said Khoi Binh Pasasun Saka Pasasamat, I said I was a volunteer here working, building wells and latrines. That's what I did. And they shook hands and several of them embraced me because they knew what that meant. That was different than the military and the CIA people that were there then. Of course, much of the generation who faced that war is now either passed on or are very elderly. There is, unfortunately, a lot of lack of understanding of what the war was about among the young people. Their books talk about the war. Yes, their history books, their textbooks are much better than ours on that level. But the fact is that most of the people who suffered from that war either are amputees today or still have the effects of the war on them. But and we met people who like, for example, I met a man who lived, he told me, we lived in the caves for 9 years because the cave was the only place where the bombs could not penetrate. Unfortunately, then the U.S. Crafted a bomb that could, using technology could get find its way into the cave, and thousands of people were killed inside the caves. But this man and his villagers lived inside a cave for 9 years, and as a result, they got scurvy. They many of them went blind as a result, or they lost their hearing. So, you know, to hear that from the actual victims of that war was profoundly strong on me.
You know, Lou, in terms of living here in the States and speaking to the everyday person on the streets, what could you say to them in reference to that because of these atrocities that has happened in Laos, that they should share some kind of responsibility to correct the wrongs? What would you say to them in terms of the behavior of the U.S. government when it goes abroad and commit these kind of terrible acts in the name of democracy, in the name of the people? What do you say to the everyday people in terms of, in other words, what kind of contribution can they give to the people in Laos for the damages and harm that we are caused? How do you see, if possible, we can pay any of this kind of debt back based upon the misbehavior of this particular government?
Well, it's difficult to imagine what that could be. Many people withhold their taxes or a portion of their taxes. One of the things that I learned, and your previous call asked about the United Nations has stated, has written that it will take over 400 years for Laos to successfully remove all of the ordnance, the bombies that are still in the soil of Laos, north, almost entirely, not entirely, but much of the soil of Laos is filled with them, those bombs. And 400 years, can you imagine planning that 400 years ahead that we still have that going on in our country? I think people have to read their newspapers, listen to their media, and say, we don't know the whole story. There's so much that we're not being told, and certainly about that kind of a warfare. And the warfare today, it's the same as always was, only far more horrendous than even ever before.
You know, I don't know if you can answer this question. I'm sorry, but go ahead, finish your point.
I was just going to say the U.S. now has over 1,000 bases around the world, military bases around the world. Is that a sign of peaceful intentions? I don't think so.
And is it a sign that the U.S. feels that they have this unchallenged global power, that they can do whatever they want to, whenever they want to? And if that a sign of that, that I think the people are in for a long, long, difficult struggle in terms of you have a few elite controlling what the world would be without the input and participation of the masses of the people globally. In the process, just making a statement, Lou, I would like you to respond to, in terms of looking at this 40-year secret war, in essence, how has the rest of the world benefited from it? Who has benefited from this destruction? Who are the players that have benefited from the description, if any?
Who has benefited? I think certainly nobody in other parts of the world. It's only the military-industrial complex that benefits from it. The people who build the bombs, the people that send contractors around the world to torture and to carry out covert activities. And there are now more people who have secret clearances, over 2 million people. Can you imagine the President of the United States? There are 13 levels of secrecy that are over his head that he doesn't even know about. That is 13 levels, and this is well documented. So a country that lives off of secrecy and lives off of the notion of supremacy and the notion of exceptionalism cannot be democratic. I'm sorry, there's a contradiction there. And so who benefits? It's those people, who benefit. I have a brother-in-law who has a top secret clearance, and he's not happy, but, you know, he continues to live that way. But the fact is that you cannot have democracy in the midst of this kind of status. It's a contradiction, and it cannot go on unless we change it.
You just lead right into one of my final questions for you. What must be done from your perspective in order to put this empire in check, this U.S. empire? What do you see in terms of what the people must do in order to change that course of history in terms of the empire running wild?
Well, if it were so easy, it would happen. I think people in several parts of the world have taken things into their own hands. I look at Venezuela. I look at Bolivia. I look at Cuba. I look at Laos. I look at Vietnam. They have to find ways to not allow their lives to be run by people who don't care for them, who don't want them to build a better life, who only want profits for themselves. And that system has got to change. And I think people in this country are looking for different ways. I mean, there's a very high level of disillusion among the American people who don't trust the government. They don't trust institutions. Why? Because they've been lied to again and again and again and again, whether it's about who killed John F. Kennedy, whether who did the World Trade Center. The official story always is a lie. And so I'm not saying that rhetorically. You just look back at all the incidents, and you see that the official story falls apart. And so people have to take the history into their own hands and not trust the institutions such as the mass media that continue to lie to them and feed them government lies.
Okay, in closing, Lou, can you just give us maybe a one-minute statement on how can people find out more about this history, the secret wall, and what your overall last feelings of what you just recently visited when you were there and when you were there in Laos?
Well, the best books on the CIA, one is by William Blum, B-L-U-M. It's called, I'm blanking on the name now, William Blum, B-L-U-M. And then also there's a lot written about the secret war in Laos, and people can find those books online. I think that, and certainly Howard Zinn has written widely on those wars, as has Noam Chomsky. So those are some of the books I could suggest. Thank you. That's what I can tell you.
And if people like to get in contact with you to bring you into their communities or their universities, how can it be done to talk on subjects like this one and others? Because you have a history of working with movements, and I'm quite sure this information is needed. So how could they reach you if there's a number or email or something where they can contact you?
Yes, I'll give you my email. It's louw, then the number 7, not the word. So louw7@live.com.
On that note, we'd like to thank Al.
Yes.
Can I finish it?
That's it.
Okay,
that's
on that note, we'd like to thank We'd like to thank our listening audience, and we'd like to thank our guest, Louis Wolf, who was sharing his perspectives on his recent visit, coming back from Laos. And we begin to become more conscientized of our history, and particularly the past, because it's the past that is a product of the present, and we didn't understand what took place in the past. We would definitely have a very difficult time understanding the present, which is going on now. So on next time, on the 22nd, you can stay tuned at the same time to turn in to Africa on the Move at 6 p.m. Again, we'd like to thank you and we'll see you on the 22nd. Remember, without information, you cannot think, and without organization, you cannot think clearly. Join some organization that's doing something for your people, and we'll see you on the 22nd. Africa on the Move. You have been listening to Brother African. Thank you.